the other members, honourable members, we will start within 2 minutes. Honourable members, am I still audible?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. I think Perrin is having difficulty opening. Double-click Perrin from an illiterate computer guy.
I think Perrin's machine is freezing.
Yeah.
Ma'am, I'm here. Let me just see. The trouble is with the floating documents. But let me try again. Is that audible?
Yes. Thank you.
Sorry. I'm sorry. I'm multitasking slightly, but yes. So if I could speak to this, this is to do with the further proposals concerning the bringing objects and displaying placards in the House. Members may recall that this issue arose, I think, quite early in this year. A member brought a placard into the House. It wasn't, in fact, the first time that members had done that. But on that occasion, the House Chair, Mr. Frolic, asked that the Rules Committee look into the rules about what members can bring or not bring into the chamber. And there was then a discussion at the last subcommittee, and there were some proposals put forward and some discussions. And on the basis of that discussion, we put forward some further proposals, which are now in this document. Just to step back a moment, you'll see National Assembly Rule 64E at the moment says members must at all times accord the presiding officers of the National Assembly and members due respect and conduct themselves with dignity in accordance with the decorum of the House and are required, and this is what the current rule says, not to bring weapons of any kind, nor dangerous or threatening articles or objects, nor replicas of any such articles or objects into the chamber, excluding cultural objects with the prior approval of the Speaker. The underline there is our emphasis. So in terms of, or based on the discussion that we had at the last meeting, there was a general view that because the House is really a platform for debate and for the exchange of views, that members should not bring placards, for a start, into the House. So that was a sort of general view, and the rule can be amended in that respect. You'll see that option one is an option to amend Rule 64. Firstly, to prohibit placards, members from bringing placards, as well as objects, except with the prior permission of the Speaker. And then the option to amend the rule also includes a prohibition on any articles, or alternatively, dangerous or threatening articles, which is in fact what the existing provision provides for. So option one is to amend the rule to prohibit placards, as well as objects, except with the permission of the Speaker. The second part of that is a prohibition on articles, alternatively only dangerous and threatening articles. Option two is instead of amending the existing rule, to provide for a guideline, which the Rules Committee is empowered to make. And this is how, in other words, the guideline informs how Rule 64 should be implemented. So the guideline would say that firstly members may not bring any weapons or placards of any kind into the chamber. So that would be basically a blanket prohibition. Two, members should seek the prior approval of the Speaker before bringing any articles or objects into the chamber, whereupon the Speaker must rule that any such object or article is dangerous or threatening, or could be considered a cultural object or article, or relevant to the proceedings of the House. So the guideline would, as it stands there, would permit, for example, members to bring books or newspapers or things of that kind, provided they did not detract from the debate. So that is really what the guideline would propose. So, ma'am, that is the proposal to do with objects and placards. I also want to speak maybe, but perhaps there could be a discussion first, if Chair, you'll have to provide some guidance. But there's also an item there on guidelines for members' backgrounds and the virtual platform. So should I continue with that, or should I pause there?
Yes, please continue with that. We'll take the two items together.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. Yes. So this was also discussed at the last subcommittee meeting, and there was basically an agreement that members, as their background, should use the current parliamentary background, which is the building. I think I can see our members have got that at the moment. or blank, I'm sorry, a blank background or blurred background or static picture of the member without parking symbols or statements. So that is the that was essentially the agreement at the last meeting. So then we've also proposed guidelines about how, or just basically to implement that position. So the guidelines you'll see on the page there, basically saying that the rules of debate apply both in the House and the platform, that that's generally understood. But therefore, the sub three there is members must use the current parliamentary background or a blank background or a blurred background or static picture of a member without party symbols or statements. So if members agreed with this position, it would then go to the Rules Committee who would, if they agreed, then adopt these as guidelines for members. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you very much, Perrin, for that presentation. Honorable members, the first item was dealing with guidelines for displaying placards and bringing objects into the House. Then the second one is that one of members' backgrounds. Can we take a discussion on these matters? I already see hands here. Honorable Gantu, followed by Honorable Singh, in that order. I'll request that if your network is stable, you can open your video. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chair. Just a response to the two issues raised. I'm hoping that we don't spend much time on this because we did discuss it substantially in our last meeting. I just raise my hand to contribute to the first point and to say that I think from this subcommittee going to the Rules Committee, that it does seem to me that option one on the issue of bringing placards and objects into the House, which we discussed at length the last time, option one is very firm with flexibility in it indicating that such things should not be allowed and provide some proviso to say in circumstances where there is a need for whatever reason to bring something that the speaker's permission is therefore sought. I would want to firmly support that we take to the Rules Committee our view that option one becomes the more proper one for us to apply. So that will be the first point. I don't think option two is very much helpful. So I want to firmly support option one. And on the issue of the background, I support those three issues raised. So as I speak, I have a blank background, just my name, or a static picture of myself, which should not be a picture of my girlfriend or wife or husband, because members of the public are trying to connect with who he speaks as a member of parliament. So it should be my picture if it's not the background of parliament. So I want to agree with those three options of a blurred, blank or static picture or the background of the House. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Gentry, for your contribution. And indeed, we discussed this at length last time. Honorable Singh?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm just apologizing on order to General Committee. Chairperson, I think on the options on the prohibition of members, what we have to think about is whether we want it in the rules or whether we want to adopt a guideline. I think the text of what is being said is similar in both instances. Now, I don't know if we need to amend the rules or adopt a guideline, and maybe we can have a further discussion on that. So the discretion would reside with the speaker or the presiding officer at that time, bearing in mind the guideline. So I don't have much of a firm position, but I don't know whether a guideline would be better than amending the rules. On the second issue, if I may speak, Honorable Deputy Chief, you see here I note that in our proposals we said that we want to get the executive to provide inputs into the matter. I don't know if we've managed to refer this matter to the executive at this stage, at the subcommittee stage, or whether we want to do it before the Rules Committee or during the Rules Committee. And secondly, I think on the issue of the background, what we have to discuss, and Honorable Janshi's went through this, is as you had correctly said at the beginning, to Honorable Janshi's chairperson, that if you are in a position, please switch on your camera. Now, I think you said that deliberately because with network problems and all, sometimes you can't. And we don't want Honorable Janshi's or any presiding officer to be put into an invidious position where a member says, listen, I can't put my camera on because of a network, and then we insist that it's there because of rules. So I think that's something we need to apply our minds to as well. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Singh, for your inputs and contribution. Honorable Papo?
The issue of the executive, there was an engagement with the executive members that they should actually have a better say, must apply to them. But there was a flexibility required for the president and the deputy, because they normally appear with the flag of the country, and an additional one would be the AU one. But all the members of the executive should either have their photo if their camera is off, or a blank background, and the third one being the background with the parliament. And if you check some of them from that time, even before the amendment to the hybrid, because this is a hybrid rules, and some of them started to do it, but some of them slip up, and then you have books and things like that, and office backgrounds and things like that. The Parliament Communication Services send the parliamentary background to all the members of ministers and deputy ministers. And that was also facilitated by the Office of the Leader of Government Business. And there was a memo from DCIS also about the matter. Starting from that time, the issue was raised. So there was no resistance about it. I think the issue is that the communications team, the PLOs, must actually assist them, and some of the members themselves must help themselves to understand what's going on through parliamentary IT if they cannot use the executive IT services. So from that side, there's no problem. There was that issue of the president and the deputy, who normally their backgrounds in many instances will have this, the country flag and the AU flag.
Thank you very much, Honorable Papo, for that update. Indeed, we have seen the changes since we discussed this in our last subcommittee meeting. So thanks for that, for the good work that you have done there. Honorable Soma?
Good morning, Honorable Chair and colleagues, and my apology as well for logging in late. It was not intentional. Having said that, I would like to say upfront that Honorable Yanji and Honorable Hope have covered me. Safe to say that it will be a problem to say you need to have a discussion of the presiding officer on a matter that also impacts negative on the decorum of the House. So the rules are made there to ensure that there is consistency in terms of its application, and the application is known. However, I take the note that in terms of showing your face, if there is a load shedding and instability of your network, that's another issue. But I think moving forward, the rules are there so that all of us, we don't second guess the presiding officer or the presiding officer use his or her own discretion. Then after that, there is inconsistency in terms of the penalty or the decision or the judgment of the presiding officer. Other than that, I'm fully covered by Honorable Janji and Honorable Hope. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Lissoma. Honorable Janji and Honorable Papo, your hands are still up.
Yes, mine is a new hand, Chair.
Okay.
That's a quick one, Chair, if you allow.
Yes.
Just on the two issues, and I'm covered by Honorable Lissoma. To just on the issue raised by Honorable Singh about whether we can leave it as a guideline or amend the rules, Honorable Singh, I would suggest that we stick to the rules, amend the rules, because once you say it must be a guideline, as Honorable Lissoma is saying, it is open to abuse, because when it is the rules will be able to even stand with those even in court. Guidelines was when you say it's better when you say a presiding officer can still use his or her discretion on rules and not on guidelines. So I'd want us to agree on it being amended as rules and not guidelines, otherwise we could be all over the place. If you've got 10 presiding officers, they've got 10 discretions in terms of the guidelines. And then on the second issue you've raised, because it was a practical issue we picked up in the mini plenary that I happened to be presiding on, because here we do agree in terms of the rules that any of the three are acceptable, a blank thing with your name, blurred or stated picture or background of parliament. Where it gets confused is the hybrid rules that presiding officers have to read up front at the start of these sessions. Then they indicate that when you speak, you must switch off your video camera. So we might need to amend that to give a particular leeway or do away with saying they must switch on their camera if we agree on these three areas of the background. So because that's where the inconsistency kind of come in, and I'm sure that can be attended. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Etanji, for attending to that matter. That as the House, we are guided by our own rules. So our rules must stand the test of time. So, yes, so really appreciate that you attended to that point. Honorable Papo?
I think the three options actually need to be factored into the guide which the presiding officer raised at the beginning, because that guide is trying to strengthen the hybrid rules, so that if you are having a network problem, your photo appears in an event where you are on the hybrid. I mean, you are on the virtual. I mean, those three options. We don't amend the rules. We factor them in. And then in the guide, those three must appear so that the guide at the beginning of the session covers that, so that then you don't have a problem. You're having a network, then you use the various options which are provided. And I think the issue must be in the hybrid, because currently we operate on the hybrid rules. That is the House rules, which are augmented by the hybrid rules we adopted. And then the one of the options, I think it's clear. The space option one offers is that if, for example, it's 16 days of activism, all political parties agree, they may actually require that they come with labels and whatever paraphernalia which the National Assembly organizes for all the various members. There may be t-shirts donated and things like that, which they use. That is how the understanding of that proposal was, so that you don't just spring up a poster, nobody knows about it, nobody was consulted, and then it creates a problem. We said that that should be dealt, you should raise whatever issue in the debate itself. So option one allows, and it has to be in the rules, because if it's in the guidelines, as Member Janji says, may be abused. So there is space so that you don't actually say objects and then things, newspaper cuttings and things like that are not allowed. But on the issue of posters, it was clear that, for example, you bring a poster in support of Palestine, somebody brings a poster in support of Israel, and then it creates a problem, because I think that's on issues. I think this option one is trying to prevent the situation where focus of the public is taken on by things. The public should hear members debating. And I think that option one is not a blanket. It says there should be some form of interaction and consultation. And usually the chief whip's forum would actually be which are celebrated or actually actually commemorated. For example, Mother's Day, people, I'm just giving example, Father's Day, those kind of days which people do actually mark, but they're not done in the house. But I think option one does that, and it needs to be there so that you don't have some of the things which happened in the past from various quarters in the house. But the fact that they say on your law, on your clothes, you should not have logos and slogans, that already tells the posture which National Assembly takes. You can wear a color, but don't put the logo, the slogans, and so on your clothes. But then we cannot then say banners must have, and there's no form of interaction, because clothes with logos and slogans are not that different to a banner being brought into the house. And I think that's why option one is very fair. We're going to have a contradiction if we allow that situation. Because clothes are like a moving asset. If it has a logo, it has a slogans and things like that. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Papa, for emphasizing on those points. I don't think there's a different view from what we are agreeing upon here. So we are saying that these must be factored into our rules, because our rules, even if we are taken, if Parliament is taken to court, the rules must stand the test of time to protect the decisions of the House. So we will take it as is to the Rules Committee for a decision. Thank you very much, Honorable Members. Can we now move on to the next item, Karen?
Yes.
And please take us.
Yes, ma'am. Quickly, I just want to get clarity. So option one seems to be the option is the option that the subcommittee is endorsing. Should
yes.
It be put exactly like it is now to the Rules Committee? I say that because this is not actually, firstly, a rule amendment. It's just proposing the principle which could be inserted into the rules. But the other element of it is this issue of articles. So maybe what could happen is that it could say placards in the house as well as other objects or articles, except with the prior permission of the Speaker. In other words, the issue of articles on this would be inserted into the general principle rather than
yes.
As separate. Okay, ma'am, yes, I understand. Sure, thank you.
Okay.
Yes, so the next agenda item is 5, so the questions procedure. I do
yes.
want to hand over to the head of the questions office, Mr. Plykes, but I also want to propose a slight rearranging of the agenda as such. It's all to do with questions, just the order. So on the agenda, it'll say update and pending proposals, which has got to do with the number of questions the minister should respond to in the House. Then there's interpolations, and the final bullet point is the report on delayed replies to questions, again from ministers. This came from the Rules Committee as well. So what I would propose is that the issue of interpolations be taken, and I say at the end, I'm talking about after those two other items, because I understand might be easier, Chair, with your permission, just to follow that sequence so that we conclude with that item. Ma'am, if you're okay with that, could I ask Mr. Plaatjes to speak to the issue of the update and pending proposals? This is also in the current document that you see at the screen. I will go.
Yes. Can take us through?
So yes.
And I agree with the altering of this agenda items.
Thank you, ma'am. If I could, can you then speak to this? You see on the screen now, it says opportunities for ministers to reply. Thank you.
Thanks, ma'am. Karen, if you could just scroll up, please. No, down it, I mean. Yeah, the issue was about the concentration of questions to particular ministers on a question day, and one of the proposals was a consideration maybe to reduce the number of questions in terms of the current quota. Currently, Rule 137.7 provides for 10 questions per minister on a question day.
Honorable Plaatjes, can you please speak closer to your mic?
Okay. Is that better, ma'am?
Yeah, even though it's like you are far away.
Oh, sorry. Currently, Rule 157, 138.7 provides for 10 questions. The number of questions to a minister is limited to 10 questions per question day. Now, because of this, we have a concentration of questions to particular ministers on the question day. Now, previously, under the previous questions rules, we used to have the rule read 4 questions per minister on a question day. We have, however, increased it, and I just want to read the old questions rule that said not more than 4 questions for oral reply shall be put to a minister in respect of any one government department on any particular question day. Now, we feel that if we may reduce it to 4 questions per minister, we may not have a concentration of parties wanting to prioritize particular questions only. And that may sort of give more other ministers an opportunity to respond to questions. But at the end of the day, ma'am, it really depends on the questions parties prioritize to ministers. And so we're just proposing that reducing the number of questions from to a minister of 10 to 4 questions as was in the previous rules. I thank you. I hand over if there's any discussion on that.
Thank you, Mr. Leike. Honorable members, here's the presentation by the questions unit, Mr. Plaatjes. Honorable Singh, followed by Honorable Kwakube.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think Mr. Plaatjes is making a very valid proposal. Because sometimes, you know, when we have these question sessions, you find some ministers, we don't even come to them. And they are sitting there as part of the cluster. So I think restricting to 4 would be good. But I would just like to add another point that maybe with Mr. Plaatjes' experience, he could. There are times when questions are unanswered because of the time lapsing after 3 hours. And from my participation in Parliament over a number of years, I know that the PLOs always had answers, written answers to all questions that were on the order paper. And can we not reintroduce that? So even if we do 12 questions for the day and there are 16 or 18 on the order paper, those answers must be tabled so that the answer can be given to the person who asked the question right then and there. It used to happen in the past. I don't see why it can't happen in the future. And even when a minister tables an answer, surely we need to also have a written hard copy of that answer that the member who asked the question can receive. That will help us greatly. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Singh. Honorable Gwakube.
Thank you, Chair. I think the proposal that's been put forward is something that I think we definitely can consider. But I do also want to pick up on Mr. Blighty's statement that, in fact, how and which ministers answer on the day actually depends on the prioritization of the political party. So which questions the political parties also prioritize. And I think that, we shouldn't necessarily just throw the baby with the bathwater, but I think there may be advantages to reducing the number of questions per day so that in regardless of who prioritizes what, then most ministers in that cluster can get an opportunity to answer questions. But I think that the issue is less about the questions per minister, but also just about which questions are prioritized. But I suppose to create a spread, a fairer spread, we could reduce the numbers as per the recommendation here at the end. I think we have more to gain than to lose in that effect. And obviously, what we want to do is we want to make sure that members of parliament have more of an opportunity to hold the executive to account. So I think it may be something we can take to the rules committee.
Thank you, Honorable Kwakube. Honorable Lusoma. Honorable Lusoma, are you there? Honorable Chanji?
No, thank you, Chair. Just briefly, Chair, I think the proposals by the NA table do make sense if you follow that almost most of the time that there is a skewed participation of ministers per a cluster on these kind of questions, because certain questions become more popular, or certain ministries, given the nature of the work they do. But it's quite not helpful that you have ministers not once coming to the house either answering just one question or no question, because we're not able to spread their participation. So it is important that we make them accountable, but it's also important that they are able across the board to share their own experiences, as well as share with the members of the public the kind of work that they do. So one does support. I don't know why they just went from 10 to 4. I don't know what would have been the problem if they just half that and make it 5 questions, perhaps instead of 4. But I think that reduction might help. We're going to need to monitor if the rules committee adopt them as to how successful that becomes. So I support the 4. I'm only saying perhaps unless there's a reason why it can't be 5. You have it from 10 to 5 and see how that works. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Janji, for your input. Honorable Papo?
I wish to second Honorable Janji because I think the issue of this question is not only about us MPs getting responses. It's to give the nation a sense of what is going on in all the clusters of government. That is why most of the ministers have to have a chance to actually respond to some of those questions. And I would urge, we should urge the Rules Committee should, and through the Chief Whip's Forum, should urge for various political parties to also do that, because it serves the nation better if they have a sense of what is going on in all the areas of government. Because if it's just like only 2, 4, 10, 8 departments, it doesn't benefit the people out there who might be listening, watching the parliament. And it also, this one has got more, this one question. What is the purpose of it? So I think the aim should be to do that. Yes, members must get the responses. Constituents of members also must be able to get those responses and the engagement. But it must generally spread across all the clusters. Thanks. And ministries.
Thank you very much, honorable members, for your inputs in that regard. And thanks, Mr. Plaikie, for that presentation. What I'm hearing here, honorable members, is that the number of questions be reduced to 4 or 5 questions. And those questions must be spread across all the cluster ministers. Indeed, we have observed that some ministers will come to the house and we will attend the house without them having to answer to a question. So that is what we are saying, that they must be spread across the cluster ministers, and also that we reduce the number either to 4 or 5. Then it will depend on how many the Rules Committee will adopt. Honorable Stoma?
No, my apology, Chair. I think I had a difficulty of unmuting myself. I agree with your summary, having listened part of it, of engagement, which is outside what we're discussing, but also impacts on the aspect. In the presiding officer's guideline, we must also say that the question, when it has been put before the House, it must be complete, not the discretion of the presiding officer, whether because of the time, but there must be that understanding that the question will be completed in terms of its follow-up, so that it doesn't look clumsy. I know previously, at one stage, while I was presiding, I was not too sure what to do, and then Honourable Dombela also, we cut the question in the middle while there were still some follow-up in terms of completing that question.
Thank you very much, Honorable Soma. I think you have triggered some hands. Honorable Papo?
Yeah, I think it makes a practical sense. It will take up to maybe 5 past, 10 past the follow-up, because just to cut follow-up questions in the middle is very clumsy. I think that's what you say. If the question is already started, first follow-up starts, the other 3 must be completed and the House ends. So the reality is that there won't be any other question after that. The other thing is raised by Member C. If there are 17 questions targeted for the day and you do 12 or 13, he's saying that those other ones which could not have been reached, the responses would be there. They must be then presented. I think that's what he's saying. I don't think he's saying all the questions which are on the order paper. I mean, on the question paper. He's saying the ones which should have been done that day, their responses should be circulated. And there's a particular number per day, usually. But you don't sometimes reach it. Say 17, we reach 13.
Thank you very much, Honorable Papo. Honorable Kwakuge?
Thanks, Chair. I think we're in agreement about the reduction of the questions and to allow a fairer spread. And then I also do want to agree with Honorable Lesuma that there needs to be consistency, because if the issue around cutting a question mid-question is left to the discretion of each presiding officer, then there isn't any consistency. So I want to agree with her and Honorable Papo that
once a question has been started, that it is then finished. And then, of course, it, you know, it will take us no longer than another 10 minutes or so. So I'd like to agree with that proposal, please. I think it's a slightly tangential issue, but I think it would be useful while we're discussing oral questions to make it to formalize.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kwakube. Honorable Singh?
Thank you, Chair. I also agree with the proposal that we don't just cut, but perhaps Perrin can just check whether the current rules don't make it compulsory that we stop 3 hours. And there is this discretion for the presiding officer to continue with a set of follow-up questions that may have started before the stop. That's the only thing they need to check. But the principle is important.
Thank you, Honorable Singh. Honorable Tenshi?
No, Chair. On my brief comment on the importance of not cutting questions in the middle so that there's a comprehensive conclusion. That is not a matter of an amendment of any rule. What needs to happen is a certain level of discipline from a presiding officer. Each question is allocated time. The only reason why some questions are not concluded but it spills over is that a presiding officer would not have stuck to her or his discipline in terms of a certain question where you allow other responses, either from, in most cases, from the minister going overboard, and then you eat into the time of the other question. So it's not a rule amendment issue. It's an enforcement issue by a presiding officer to stay within the allocated kind of time limit. I've seen that, you've watched that, and it can only work better if presiding officers stay consistent in terms of being firm that your time has lapsed. You can have the leeway of allowing 5 seconds, 6 seconds, but once they get into even a response going over a minute beyond what was allocated, that's when it creates problems in that regard. So I just wanted to make that point, Chair, because everything is done within the 3 hours. So you just need to be very focused and disciplined around how that time management is made. It's not a rule amendment.
Thank you very much, Honorable Zanji, for bringing that up. The question session is 3 hours. Then the first supplementary question, a member is given 2 minutes to raise their questions. I think I'm correct here. You'll correct me, Perrin and Mr. Blighty, if I'm wrong. Okay, thank you very much. The other three supplementary questions is 1 minute each. So what we have seen in the House is that members will make preambles before they get to asking the question. And sometimes when the presiding officer says, your time is up, even before that member asks their supplementary question, then it's taken as if the presiding officers don't want to give the members an opportunity to ask the question. What we are saying here is that presiding officers must be strict on time, and also in the Chief Whip's Forum, we need to emphasize this point so that we prepare our members, we educate them that supplementary question, the first one is 2 minutes, then the second one is 1 minute. There's no need for preambles. Thank you very much, honorable members. The questions, we agree that they must be spread across cluster ministers. We reduce them to 4 or 5. Then presiding officers must be firm on time so that we don't go beyond the 3 hours. Thank you very much, honorable members. Can we now move on to the next item, Karen?
Yes, ma'am. So the next item is, as I said, if we reshuffle the agenda slightly, the report, I'll put it on the screen now, to do with reasons given by Cabinet members on delayed replies to questions. this report was presented also to the Rules Committee, and Mr. Plakis will speak about it. But essentially, the Rules Committee wanted or referred the issue of draft guidelines relating to delayed replies or replies in general. And I think the intention there was that subcommittee have a look at the draft guidelines in particular to see how, whether they were appropriate. And then if they are subject to any amendments, to return them to the Rules Committee for agreement. So if I could just ask the Plakis to speak to that, I will then put up the report on the screen. Thanks.
Thank you, Perrin. Mr. Plakis?
Yes, thanks, ma'am. The reason why we have maybe brought this to the Rules Committee and the Rules Committee referred it to the subcommittee is because...
Sorry, Mr. Plakis.
Yeah?
Karen, your budget is frozen. So you haven't displayed any in the report here. On the screen. The report is not on the screen. It's still not on the screen.
Sorry. It's an extra F. Oh, no, I see it's different.
Okay, while you're still struggling to display the report, can you please proceed, Mr. Plakis?
Yes, thanks, ma'am. Well, the reasons why it came to the subcommittee was referred to it by the Rules Committee because we brought the reasons ministers provide to why the questions are not being replied to on time. Now, in terms of the system that was adopted by the National Assembly in terms of Rule 136 for the monitoring of outstanding or unanswered questions, the Speaker quarterly writes to ministers about unanswered questions. And ministers are then requested to provide their reasons. And ministers have responded to the Speaker, and some of the reasons in the main were therefore provided. Some reasons were that the nature of the questions were technical and it therefore takes time to reply to it. Another reason was that questions relate to provinces, local governments or entities over which ministers have no or very limited control. And the other reason was challenges arising from changing departmental management. Now, these reasons were reasons in the main, and so we made some recommendations following these reasons, and some of those recommendations are proposed as draft guidelines. The first one is that the executive may not exceed the 10 working days as per Rule 146 and or 145. The executive must answer each and every point raised in a question in a comprehensive manner, and members of the cabinet must attend to the management around parliamentary questions within the departments. And the fourth point that the guideline is where matter falls outside the responsibility of a minister, a minister should expeditiously provide the respective member with the response as to the reasons why the matter does not reside in the affected department. Where departments co-sponsor projects in provinces or local government, ministers should only provide a response as to what their participation or role is in such a project. Replies to questions which are commonly known as holding replies do not constitute a reply to a question and should not be processed as such. And the leader of government must consider the cost implications of questions to departments and make recommendations arising in this regard to the Rules Committee. And while best practice determines that questions can seek information dating back as far as 30 years, the LOGB should provide the Rules Committee with a reasonable cut-off period, especially to source technical or statistical information. Those are our inputs, man. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Plaki, for that presentation. Honorable members, here's the presentation by Mr. Plaki. They take us on this one with regard to delayed responses. Honorable Singh, followed by Honorable Suma.
Yeah, thank you very much, Shepherd, and thank you to Mr. Plaki. You see, the reasons provided by ministers, while some of them can be acceptable, I think it's common courtesy, and I'm referring here again to what is being proposed under 7. Replies to questions, which are commonly known as holding replies, do not constitute a reply to a question and may not be processed as such. But I think we must relook at that, because sometimes it's common courtesy to indicate to the table that, well, we are awaiting technical information from province A or province B, and it may take us another 5 days, so that the member can be informed that your question is being answered. But then, Honorable Chair, there are ministers who are repeat offenders here, if I may say so. And if Mr. Plaki had some time, he could have shared with us the ministries that don't respond within this prescribed time. And I think the Office of the Leader of the Government Business has got to do something about this. We've got Rule 145.5A. We've got a mechanism that we approved that the Speaker must write to LOGB. But to what extent is this being put into practice, and what kind of responses are we receiving other than the general reasons provided by ministers? I think getting written responses are very important to us, because we do it on behalf of constituents. And if we say we have to get responses from other provinces, I mean, I had a question maybe put in a few months ago, and I got the answer from the province before the national minister responded, because they say, well, we've already sent a response to the national minister. And then it still took them weeks to process that response to us. So I think we've really got to relook at this. And, you know, I would even propose that if we say that 145.5A says we must give them 10 days, maybe we should increase that to 15 days. And you know, then don't get any excuses thereafter. So it's just something that I just wanted to put on the table. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Singh. Switch off your video, please, Honorable Singh. Honorable Singh, please switch off your video. Thank you. Thank you for that input, Honorable Singh. Honorable Isoma.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I think the whole purpose of us engaging on this matter is for questions that are being asked to the executive are responded to. One, Chair, I don't think our intention was to dictate how the ministers respond, but also bearing in mind that their responses are empowering us as members, as well as the population or the country or the citizens or the voters. However, I would suggest that if you calculate, Chair, before the suggestion, 1994 to date, that gives you 20 years. The 30 years, then, it by default, it makes the executive to account for the workings of the apartheid government, if I may use that word, which is the factual one. And I don't think it's going to be fair. So the date, the 30 years must be reviewed to be according to the current democratic dispensation, so that they are also able to take that full confidence of the account. That's one. I think that initially it has been an oversight, because we create an impression that we can account for apartheid misfortunes. That's one. Two, Chair, in terms of responding to the timeline, in terms of the members to respond, the table that we circulate during the beginning of the year in terms of the interviews of the clusters questions, it does give ample time. However, maybe there's a challenge, the submission thereof in terms of the deadline, that the questions are then submitted at the, towards the end of the deadline that it's supposed to allow that every time for the minister to do his investigation. We must also bear in mind here that a minister cannot dictate to say the department or the municipality or provincial government, give me this information now. Of course, the minister must indicate on time to say, I'm still trying to source the information. All in one chair, what I'm saying is that the questions, there's no way that the rules want to dictate the format and the manner that the ministers must respond. However, the usefulness of the response must assist a member and the electorate. Secondly, I'm suggesting that the 30-year backwards should change to accommodate the 1994, probably to be proper to use a year than the years, because you are not too sure even this 30 years back, when did it started? Probably it has ended already. But I'm saying as a lighter note, that's what my two takes, points, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Lisoma, for your input. Honorable Kwakube.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm inclined to agree with on the last. Sorry, can you go down on the last guideline? on the information dating 30 years back. I mean, I think perhaps here. I mean, the intention is not necessarily. You know, you could say that you know you can't seek information dating back before 1994. You could add that there, but I also think that saying as far as 30 years is also an important one, because say in 20 years time, I mean, if people are going to be asking questions that go beyond 30 years, even when you submit prior applications in departments, there's a certain cutoff time that they can't be reasonably expected to provide responses. So I would make an input to say, while it's best practice, while best practice determines that questions can seek information dating back as far as 30 years, so it should provide a reasonable cutoff period and include the 30 years or 1994. I'm making an input there because, like I said, we're not necessarily drafting these rules for now, but we can also be drafting them for the future. And then if we can go to recommendation 5, if you can go up. So the this chair is quite important. I'm getting a number of complaints, particularly from members who are very involved in constituency matters and use written questions as a way to ask constituency matters to ministers. And so I think number 4 and 5 are an important consideration, because I can understand that no minister can provide a response on behalf of another sphere of government. But instead of simply saying where, and we get this with COGTA a lot, and I think it's because of the nature of the portfolio. But I think instead of ministers simply saying, you know, I can't respond to this question, whatever, they should say, this is where my responsibilities lie. And in so far as my responsibilities lie, this is the response. And then questions can be asked at the relevant authority. But I think ministers need to be sensitized to the fact that it's not good enough to just simply say, well, I'm not going to answer this. It doesn't affect me, particularly with departments such as COGTA and others that have a cross-cutting responsibility. So I would really emphasize number 4 and 5 as being communicated and sensitized to the executive as well. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kwakube. Honorable Papo?
Yes, I think the whole issue is relating to the management of questions for written reply, where, for example, members, firstly, the issue of about if there is an extension to be given application being done through the by the ministry. Secondly, interacting with members from the ministry who have asked questions, so that they have a sense that there are questions that have not been put aside and will be seen after 3 months. So that whole issue of engagement with the members by the ministry is very, very important, and that's an issue with the LOGP is raising with ministries. Thirdly, from the questions office, if there are questions they see themselves, questions, this is not linked to the mandate of the department. I think it should be urgently done. And if the ministry already, it has passed already, the ministry should not do it in the house. They should do it before that, so that that question can be rerouted to the relevant ministers. And honestly, more days will then have to be given. It's the whole tightening of that system, so that we don't have what happened in one of the sittings where questions are responded to in the house, not having belonged to it. So from both the questions office and the ministry, there should be that tightness in terms of ensuring that members may have done a mistake, and that should be corrected in the first day or two of that question having arrived, so that it can be removed. For me, that's tightening of that. And then the issue of strengthening overall management of the work of the ministries with both parliament, I mean NA and the NCOP, and then ensuring that at the provincial level, when it comes to concurrent powers, that issue is also tightened, because the delays happen there, but sometimes, as Member Singh says, the response has been given and there's a whole problem. But then there are departments, obviously they may not respond because of the technical nature, but there are departments which are not don't have concurrent powers. They are actually national, their powers are national with implementation at the provincial level, but sometimes not even provincial, like ECO, defense and so on. So the process must be tightened. For me, it's a whole question of strengthening the interactions between ministry, parliament, provinces, and provinces themselves must tighten the issues with the local municipalities, because some of those answers may have to be sourced there. If we strengthen that, some of the problems should not be. And generally understanding that parliament is an important platform, ministers cannot spend their entire time in parliament. They have to also do outreach work in communities. But the issue is also this silence which happens. And then deadlines are passed. Members then have not even been elected that a minister has asked for an extension. We need to tighten and manage that process between the NA and the LOGB, the ministries themselves, through the PLOs. Thanks.
Thank you very much, honorable members. Honorable Papo, we appreciate the work that the leader of government business office is doing. We fully agree with you that there is a need to strengthen communications between national and provincial and also the municipalities, and also to ensure that those questions are responded to members on the record time. So we need to work very hard to tighten this, so that if a minister, I see your hands, Honorable Plucky. Well, Mr. Plucky, then Honorable Papo. Mr. Plucky?
Yes, thank you, ma'am. Ma'am, the reason why we made these proposals, especially on matters falling outside the responsibility of ministers and where they have limited control over those matters, are precisely because of Rule 154.5b. And the rule basically states questions must relate to matters for which cabinet ministers are officially responsible. And this rule is in no small measure based on Section 92(3)(b) of the Constitution that reads as follows. Members of the Cabinet must provide Parliament with full and regular reports concerning matters under their control. And the problem is that if we are going to extend questions to the point where members may ask constituency matters that does not fall within the purview of a minister, then we are going to continue having a problem with replies being late and not answered and lapse even to an extent. And that's why we simply want to ask that the subcommittee consider the extent to which ministers are able. I mean, I have an example of a reply of the Minister of Cooperative Governance, the Minister of Basic Education. This reply was on the matter in 2009, or 2013 at least, when she had to answer a question in the on with regard to searches and seizures within schools. And the Western Cape government gave the minister the information that nothing was searched and seized, and so the minister replied. However, the very next moment, the newspapers reported that the minister misled Parliament. And this is, and what eventually had to happen was that the ANC under Ms. Kubai brought a member statement into the House, which then offered the minister to respond and correct the information. Now, where you have more and more provinces or maybe municipalities being run by opposition governments or parties, you may then have difficulties on this cooperation. And therefore, because ministers don't control the information that is within those municipalities, they make national legislation. And this national legislation expects of this of them then to manage local government. And these are therefore the reasons why, and one will see in the reply, I just want to respond that Mr. Singh say maybe extended from 10 to 15 days. But international best practice has even reduced it to 7 days in Denmark. In India, it is 10 days. And in other constituencies like the UK Parliament, is even up to 3 to 5 working days. So we will sort of be looking outside international best practice in terms of where we want to go with regard to ministerial replies. And it will only be because ministers will have to be responsible for matters that they don't control. And the Constitution is clear. They account to Parliament on matters under their control. And this is what the rule 154(5)(b) expects. And that's why we have exceeding difficulties in the questions office with local government and provincial questions where ministers just don't have control over that information and will have to rely on those ministries to respond to it. And if it is an opposition party, it may be more difficult for them to get it. Thanks, man.
Thank you very much, Mr. Plaki. Honorable Papo?
I think Mr. Plaki says the issues I wanted to come back to, because there was a member from another party who had raised the question. I asked about I said, but what can it be? I know some parties don't have MPLs in the provinces, but that party had an MPL. Can this question not be asked by your MPL? And remember, the question was asked by the MPL in the province. Another one had a member, they had a member in the municipality. The question was directed to the MMC in the municipality. So I'm just saying that this area of provincial concurrent powers is very difficult for some of the ministers, because it's a sphere. It's not only where there's opposition or governing party. the dragging of the feet in responding is linked to the fact that there is fear, we cannot be compelled, and so on, which sometimes create complications in the management. But overall, I think we need to strengthen the area, this area. But this thing that we, people must answer all the questions in point form, because sometimes you can, questions are not only about, they are also about political issues. Now, a minister can actually summarize all the 4 points into a principle response, policy principle. You can say, but you haven't answered subsection B, subsection C. But the response is, it explains the principles around the issue, the policy around the issue, and what are the intentions on the programs. So I think it may create a problem, that thing that they must answer in detail. It means that people are going to, it's the same as when you don't like an answer. You say there was no response. Yes, the one of yes, no, make it. But ministers have a right to do that, but it's not advisable to do it. So how do we deal with that issue, members, of having to answer? Because we're in a political terrain and platform, and you have to respond according to policies of your of the party, I mean the government, which is there. And now members are going to say, you know, but this one, this subsection has not been answered. But you have actually summarized all the 4 points into a response and then engage the member politically. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes the differences are political differences, program differences. It's not necessarily because of an ATP matter or strategic plan. And we have to accept that the governing party cannot implement policies of the opposition. It has to implement what is in the strategic plan, APP, with weaknesses which we have noted. But I think we must, our members must be of us also understand. Because the question sometimes is linked to a policy of that party. And then they expect the minister to respond to that policy. And when he says, but I'm not responding to that policy, you are dodging a to respond. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Papo, for bringing that up, that some questions can also be directed to the provincial legislature for those members who are there to respond to. So, Honorable Soma?
No, Chair, I was going to step down, not to say anything, because what is being raised in terms of reference to the Constitution and also the intergovernmental relations, I think we need just to flag that one to refer it to a relevant committee so that also can incorporate taking the material conditions of different parties and the coalitions that are not stable and all that, but in terms of assisting also Parliament to assist the executive when they respond to questions. There's something to do with the laws that needs to be reviewed. I think there was that committee which was called the Constitutional Review Committee that is chaired by Professor Motrecha, and I think I just need to be lifted up so that can be looked at separate to the workings of the committee, because it does also raise some legal issues which needs to be paid attention or for the incoming administration. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Soma. Mr. Plucky? Your hand is up, Mr. Plucky.
Oh, sorry. I forgot to unmute myself, ma'am. Thanks, Ms. I want to agree with Ms. Soma that we rather very carefully consider matters that are concurrent, that reside within provinces, and maybe reconsider them for further discussion, etc., so that we very carefully think about how we expect provinces to assist with regard to national questions. Because, as Mr. Singh said, you could get a response from the province far quicker than the minister could. Because members and their parties have representation within provinces, within local government, within municipalities. And sometimes, because things may not work well for them there, doesn't mean that they must burden the national minister to obtain the information for them. Because it then turns the national minister into a bit of a post office. The I just wanted to respond also. No, that's it. Thanks, man.
Thank you very much, Mr. Plaki, for your response and inputs. I think, honorable members, we need to make use of what is before us. Those parties with representation in the legislatures, they can make use of that so that we don't burden our ministers, and also to allow ministers to do their work as per the constitution. So let's work around that and make sure that we get the necessary responses that members would want to get. But making use of those who are represented in their municipalities and the provincial legislature. Thank you very much for that. Honorable Mr. Pardon? Can we move on to the next item, please?
Yes, ma'am. Could I just ask a point of clarity? In terms of the task that was given to the subcommittee, my understanding, and I might be wrong, is that that the subcommittee could endorse essentially the principles that are being articulated here in these guidelines, but it seems to me that they're also saying that further work is needed to perfect these guidelines before they become enforced. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Thanks. Sorry,
you're on mute. Oh, thank you very much. I think you have captured it correctly. That's the understanding. Thank you. Can we now move on to the next item?
Yes, thank you, ma'am. So the next item is the submission by the Chief Whip of the Opposition on interpolations. And she must guide me in terms of, she did write to the chair, but she must guide me in terms of whether she wants anything flighted on the screen. Thanks.
Okay. Honorable Kwakube?
Thank you very much, Chair. As you remember,
can we have your submission flighted on the screen, please?
Right.
Honorable Kwakube?
Yes, I'm waiting for Perrin to flight it, please, Chair.
Okay. Thank you.
Perrin, if you could please display my submission, and then after that, your guys' document, because I think it answers some of the questions that the members of the subcommittee had about why the interpolations were done away with. But let's start with my submission, and then we can move on to your document.
Thank you, ma'am. Is it visible?
Oh. There's nothing here, Karen. While Karen is still struggling with this gadget, can you please proceed, Honorable Kwakube?
All right. Thanks. Okay, I think she's almost there. No? Okay. No, so Chairperson, as you'll remember, previously I made proposal to the
committee. Sorry, Honorable Kwakube. Keep on trying, Perrin. There's nothing on the screen except for your image. Thanks.
Chair, I had made a proposal to the Rules Committee, and I think perhaps just to briefly put it in context as to why this is important. There it is. You just need to maximize it. And perhaps why in my view this is important is that, of course, one of the things that we've got to do as a parliament in a wholesale fashion, and I think this committee, this subcommittee and the Rules Committee in general is very important to that work, is that we need to start looking at how have the rules of parliament become deficient insofar as holding the executive to account and allowing parliament to do its work. We would have seen a lot is being said about how parliament is doing his work from the Zondo Commission in, as an example. And so really we want to start thinking about how do we strengthen oversight. And so one of the things that I looked at in how we strengthen oversight is the is interpellations as a tool of exercising oversight on the executive. And I realized that interpellations were previously part of the NA rules, and they were at the time they were simply suspended temporarily back in 2000 as a resolution of the assembly. But the suspension was the temporary one, and so it seemed as though it was carried out until at some point when the rules were drafted again. The addition of interpellations was done away with. And so I want to then, before I hand over back to you, Chair, is why do I think interpellations are important? One, we've just had a conversation, a very important discussion on both oral and written questions about the importance of them, the importance of the responses from the ministers and the like. And my view is that, you know, interpellations will add depth to the interactions that members have with ministers, because often the problem is not necessarily, I mean, Honorable Lesuma and other house chairs and other presiding officers who sometimes preside over the house will know one of the big issues that we have and sometimes are a point of contention in the house is that members will say, no, the minister did not answer my question. And a presiding officer is unable to dictate to the minister how they've answered the question. Ultimately, a minister could stand up and say, I-A-E-O-O. And, you know, in so far as what the rules provide for, they've responded in that oral presentation. But at least if we have interpellations, which are essentially many interactions between members of parliament and members of the executive, where there's an in-depth discussion and a back and forth on a particular issue. Our view is that it will deepen the oversight mechanism, and it will also just entrench deeper the idea of executive oversight and take forward even some of what the oral questions are able to achieve. And so can you go down a little bit, Perrin? Further down, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, so that the proposed solution now is here, that interpolation be reintroduced in the National Assembly rules. I, from our reading, I mean, there was never a substantive reason why these were done away with. And what do we have to lose except to gain an ability to, one, entrench accountability further? And secondly, I think that Parliament will also send a strong message that we are introspecting and learning from some of the outcomes or some of the findings that have been made against the institution about not doing oversight properly. That it will send a strong message that we are learning and we're tightening our system. The discontinuation in 2000 was not based on anything other than the fact that, you know, it just kind of fell away. So our view is that there should be a reintroduction of interpellations into the rules. And of course, we can go into the deeper details about how we do that and how we marry that with oral question sessions. But that is our submission, that I think this is an international best practice for accountability in the House. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kwakube. Did you leave something else?
No. I don't know how you want to handle it, whether you want parents and them to share their documents.
Honorable Kwakube, allow me to share the meeting. Thank you.
Apologies.
Perrin.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you please present your documents?
Yes, ma'am. I've actually got some help now, so I'm going to ask my help to please flight documents Annexure B, and then I'll ask my colleague, Mr. Plykes, who was the head of questions office to again speak to that input there. So if I could just give me half a second, it will be Alicia B, and then it will be a bit further down. You'll see how efficient it is now with my colleague. a page or two down, and then a bit more. Sorry, there. If Mr. Plakis could just speak to that on interpolation. Sorry, it's a page up. There we go. Stop. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Jim.
Hi, ma'am.
Mr. Plakis?
Yes, thank you, ma'am.
Yes, please come to the mic.
Yes, can you hear me, ma'am?
Yes.
I just want to say the main difference between the interpolation and the current questions process is that the interpellant has an opportunity to come back into the session and respond to the minister before the minister closes. With the questions at the moment, the main question or the original questioner doesn't come back into the question session. We used to have it where a main questioner could take another bite at the cherry when we were still in the House in the National Assembly and we pressed buttons, and there may be a vacant opportunity and that minister and the presiding officer may give it to that main questioner. But the practice is that the main questioner doesn't come back into the question session under the current question system. With the interpolation, we also have 15 minutes allocated to it. With questions, we have 17 minutes allocated to it. With the interpolation, you have 3 minutes the minister reply to the interpolation, 3 minutes the interpellant respond to the minister's reply, 2 minutes another member speaks, 2 minutes the minister speaks, 2 minutes another member speaks, 2 minutes the interpellant speaks, and 1 minute the minister closes and replies to the debate, and that is altogether 15 minutes. With questions, we have 4 minutes the minister replies to the main question, 2 minutes the main questioner asks his or her supplementary question, and he or she may make a statement before or not even ask a question in terms of the questions process. And then you have the subsequent three supplementaries to which the minister responds 2 minutes each that is given to other members. And that is the main difference that we have currently on the question system and the interpolation. And I must say, we're currently spending 17 minutes on the current question system, and we used to spend 15 minutes on interpolation. Now, there were a number of reasons that was offered as to why interpolations were no longer effective. It was because 4 interpolations were permitted on a question day of 15 minutes each, taking up 1 hour of the question session, and leaves a half an hour or 30 minutes to other questions, ordinary questions on the question paper. And that was never sufficient. I mean, currently we only deal with 2 questions within 30 minutes. Now, under the previous system, we probably dealt with about 4 or 5 questions under the system at the time. And it is therefore up to this subcommittee to determine whether it wants to go back to interpolations. And I must say, in the debate on it on the 26th of June 2002, when it was finally agreed on this current question system, there were some parties that held out the option of bringing the interpolation back, although they were agreed with abolishing the system for now, as they enjoy more participation within the current questions process, especially for minority parties, etc. And that's basically my contribution, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Mr. Plakin. Listening to your presentation, oh, Mr. Castle, how are you? You are welcome to the meeting. Please take the stand.
I'm well, thank you, ma'am, and my apologies. I had to be at another meeting, and apologies. I think the one point to make from our point of view as the administration, we don't really favor any of the two, but we just want to put out that the question session that we now have now has 3 hours, for instance, which really the intention was to create more space, more questions to be dealt with, and also more opportunities for parties to participate. So we thought that should just be borne in mind. We do think that there is room for reduction of perhaps of the number of questions that are asked to a minister, so that you can have an opportunity for more portfolios to be interacted with during a question session, particular question session. But those are issues that that we think this committee in its wisdom will have to grapple with. But yeah, that is what I wanted to add. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Castle. As I was trying to say something before you raised your hand, I was saying that listening to the presentation by Mr. Blood makes me wonder why it was discontinued, if that was a very effective method to deal with question sessions. And another thing is to agree with you, Mr. Castle, that our parliament is a multi-party parliament. Do interpellation allows for all members of parliament to interact with ministers, or that one is limited to one party or two parties only? So in our discussions, let's come out with those responses to the questions that I'm posing. Honourable members, here is the presentation with regard to interpellations. Do they promote multi-party democracy system or multi-party parliamentary participation, or is the system that monopolizes? Honourable Singh, followed by Honourable Papo and Honourable Soma, then Honourable Janji. Thank you, in that order.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. Firstly, Honourable Chairperson, just to respond to your questions, interpellations can only enhance the question of accountability. And we as Parliament have a constitutional mandate to hold ministers accountable for what happens or does not happen in their departments. Now, whilst one may argue that, yes, we have the question session, I believe that interpellations are a more lively way of engaging with the minister. And I do not think we should see it as an opportunity for the opposition, just to have a debate with the minister. We should also see it as an opportunity for the minister to have more time to respond to issues that are raised in the interpellation. So it's not a one-way thing, it's a two-way thing. And insofar as it being monopolized by certain parties, perhaps the system that we have currently of the parties and what slots they get can be used. So the ANC will have a slot, all the parties will have a slot, and we can use the current system that we use for member statements, for motions, et cetera, and come up with the details of how perhaps two interpellations during the 3-hour question session can be allowed whenever we have the question session. And we can reduce the kind of questions we've got now from 3 hours to 2.5 hours and set aside 30 minutes for two interpellations that will come on a roster basis. But I don't think it'll be, even be a train smash if we have to increase our time to 3.5 hours. But that's something that we need to consider. But I support the principle of us engaging and allowing the minister and the members to get more information on the issue that they are placing on the table. It's worked. It works in provinces. It's worked everywhere else. I've had experience of it. And I think it's a good thing that we must introduce these mini debates, if you want to call it. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Singh. Honorable Papo.
I'm not convinced with this interpellation thing. I participated in it in the first term of our democracy and a bit in the second term when it was also cancelled in the Gauteng legislature. And question time was strengthened. I don't understand why we're not talking about mini plenaries, because mini plenaries also allow for political engagement between the various political parties. It gives more time to smaller parties, which are not part of the three or four bigger parties in the MA and the NCP. We must not change things. Instead, we should strengthen and make them work better. Well, we just discussed the issue of how do you make question time even better by spreading questions across the ministers in the various clusters. We've just talked about how do you strengthen questions for oral reply. When interpellations were there, many plenaries were not there. And some of the issues in the many plenaries are then brought back into the plenaries. Unless I'm convinced, except the banter between ministers and MPs, I don't see the value. We should more strengthen the question time and the many plenaries. Because we should not say there was nothing which replaced. There were no mini plenaries at that time. The question time was not as extended as it is. We should also strengthen the question sessions and ensure that the responses is not what members like, but there are responses based on the plans of government and not maybe yes, no, yes, no, which we used to sometimes had in our legislature. And MECs had the right to do so because the rules allowed them to answer it through a yes or no. So I read the document. I don't know how that actually improves is better than the mini plenaries and the question session. Sometimes reintroducing things without looking at what we have and making it work better is not good work, way of working.
Thank you, Honorable Papo. Honorable Isoma?
Okay, let me say yes. Thank you so much. I think let's appreciate the new thought that Honorable Kwakube has raised, notwithstanding that sometimes you think it's a new idea, whereas it has been in existence. But nevertheless, Chair, building up on the points that Honorable Papo has raised, is that precisely we, as the ANC in particular, let me just say that, we were mindful that if it was up to us, we would have had more time. If you recall, Chair, small and other parties in this administration, they requested more minutes to speak in divisions, in declarations and all that, and we acceded to that because we're mindful that there are various political parties now, more parties that have been voted into the parliament by the choice of their electorate. And we cannot suppress them. And we have been allowing that, which is good. But also in doing so, in that good gesture, we also abandon some of the rules in terms of its strict application because we are not dogmatic by our nature. However, when also we introduced the mini plenaries, as correct as Honorable Hope says, we were wanting to give more small parties to have a chance to debate at any given time of the calendar year, if I may use that. Even now, last week, as early as last week,
some political parties were still urging us to put more in the plenary so that they can have time to engage on matters and make the executive account indirectly or directly in terms of engagement. Two, Chair, is that like the earlier point that agenda item that we're discussing in terms of the question to the executive, we're seeking also to give more time for members to engage with the executive in the form of questions. And now we're bringing this one. In an essence also, which I don't think that's what it's intended to do, is to keep members of the executive in parliament, whereas we also expect them to deliver and to lead in their department. But also the engagement, it will for me, without having any experience from the legislature, a sort of an organized chaos, so to say, where the member would be told that you didn't respond to my question, but also the member would have responded, having no control on that information from local government or provincial government, but will be in that spirit of engagement expected to respond and have something and haze on her fingertips. And in short, Chair, for now, let it be a matter on discussion, but for now, it would not necessarily work for us with all other concessions that we have put, and also to ensure we're not doing a favor for other political parties, Morangena political parties, but also if then we want to undermine the proportional representation, let's bring all these other new reforms in engaging with the executive, because I didn't hear the presentation talking to saying that because in committees, members of parliament who are not necessarily members of those committees are not allowed to speak in those committees and ask questions. I'm very skeptical, Chair, but in clearly I'm saying that I'm not in support of reintroducing the tabulation for now. And what we have with all other political parties, it works for us, and let's just perfect it until further notice if there's any good reason for that. For now, I don't think we need to revert back to what we did in the previous fourth and the third term. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Lusoma. Honorable Kwakuba.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to make one or two points, Chair. The one thing is we mustn't mistake what mini plenaries. In fact, no, let me just take a quick step back. Chair, I think we've also all got to admit, regardless of which political parties we represent, we've got to admit that Parliament has more than on one occasion been found wanting in terms of being able to conduct its accountability on the executive. That is an objective fact that we all know. And so, yes, we've got systems in place that work and we want to strengthen them, but let's not clamp down on and strengthening those and adding to them so that we can make the institution work better. I think that's the first thing. The second thing is, Honorable Lusoma talks about organized chaos and the like. The reality is that I think, again, the function of Parliament is not to keep some kind of order and some kind of formulaic list. You've done this, you've done that, therefore the 3 hours is done, we must leave. I think we must look and ask ourselves about the impact of these things. And so accountability is not going to be a neat box thing where we say, well, members of Parliament come in and they get answered the questions and they leave. If members of Parliament are of the view that certain questions are not being answered to in a satisfactory level, we must have a recourse for them to be able to ask a question as a follow-up question, not just in the current system that we have. Then the third thing is that I don't think, Chair, it's an either or. And this is my plea to the subcommittee. This is not a matter of do we shelve oral questions in favor of interpellation. I'm asking that we look at introducing a hybrid system of both of these things, because both of them, oral questions and interpellations, serve two different functions. They allow for in-depth accountability
in a way that oral questions cannot necessarily achieve. So I think it's not fair to simply say, well, let's rather choose this over that. I think that we can have both in a way that is productive. And this notion that we want to keep members of the executive in parliament to the detriment of their work, I mean, I disagree with that. I think, again, there is a way to integrate these things where you've got interpellations and oral questions. Either you do half-half in this question session. The point is here, Chair, is that if there is a will, we can make it work. And then the last thing is to just, I think Honourable Topo raises this, and I think I need to completely debunk it. The purpose of mini plenary is not the same purpose as oral questions or interpellations. The purpose of mini plenaries was to allow more political parties to bring their motions of discussion to the House, and then those discussions to be brought to the broader House for a decision. That is a completely different accountability mechanism. Again, I want to emphasize, it's not either or. It's not about saying we've already got this, therefore we can't have another. We can enhance the way that Parliament works, and we can essentially be seen as an institution that knows how to interface, especially considering that we have been found wanting in our work. That's all, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Kwakube. Honourable Sin?
Yeah, thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, firstly, I think we must try and desist from using the term small Anyanana parties. Because today, the big party who think they are big, tomorrow they'll be small. And we don't want to call parties small and big. Everybody has a right to have representation in Parliament, and we should respect that right. So I think that's the first thing that I want to say.
Secondly, Chair, I'm sorry, Honourable Singh, may I just apologize if I was lacking a better English word on that? No offense to anyone.
Thanks, Honourable Isoma. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that. Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I think the other thing is, you know, we should not be looking at rules for political parties, whether they are a party with one member or a party with 200 members. We should be looking at rules that will enhance the way Parliament functions as an institution. And one of the ways of accountability is this issue of interpellations. And I would really urge that even if we can't agree now, that we apply our minds, take it to caucuses, and then come back with a position where we may say, let's find each other along the line. Because, you know, today, a ruling party of today will be in opposition tomorrow. And I'm not saying that's what's going to happen with this ruling party, but that's how the cycle goes. So, you know, whatever we do today must be relevant, you know, in the future as well, because we may want to hold somebody else accountable later on, and we won't have the mechanisms to do so. But I would stop at that point, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Singh. Honourable Tianji?
Honourable Chair, thank you very much. I'm largely covered by all the colleagues that would have spoken, because I think it's important to understand why there is a subcommittee on the rules. It's created in order for us to get deeper into these issues, because the main rules committee processes kind of decisions. So this is a space where we need to table issues and engage with each other on those issues. Hence, it focuses on dealing with these technical issues. That's my first point I want to make. And in that regard, we must just be robust amongst ourselves, so that you get into this discussion almost with your cap off in terms of what you represent, but deal with the issues square on. The second point I want to make, Chair, by way of context, I think the last time and now, there's a theme that is running through that says, and I don't know how we fix it. It says,
in the past, with less time, we're able to get through many questions and a lot more things. This time around, with more time, we have less questions, so you're bringing more time and getting more things, but there doesn't seem to be that kind of a balance. It's important to take that into account as we debate this, so that you don't just introduce issues for the sake of doing that. We must make the assessment as to effectiveness of what we have and what we're really introducing. There's a point, maybe before I go to this point of accountability on the executive, just to share, Honorable Singh and other members, that I have seen both sides of, I have experienced interpellation as a member of the legislature in the Western Cape, and I would have experienced interpellations from the point of being an opposition, but also experienced that from the point of being the executive, the governing party. I have both sides to it, the issue of interpellations, and I used to enjoy either way interpellations as a form of mini debate. My issue here that persuades me in the discussion is that when I had that in the legislature, Honorable Khwarube, I never had your mini plenaries. So you've got this invention, you've got this creation in the National Assembly of mini plenaries across the four or five clusters that we have, that you could have them almost happening now that it's virtual. You could have them happening at the same time with different topics and different issues, and you almost have got everybody engaging in that. And so the question that I would have asked, which is not addressed and answered now, is the issue of mini plenaries, as you would, because it does seem to me to be an upgraded kind of your interpellation in that regard, because even in mini plenaries, a member introducing a topic has got an opportunity at the end to come back. And so we just need to understand as to where the gap is and what is that you need to attend. I mean, for example, when you speak about the need to deepen the accountability on the executive, which we all agree, whether you are in the opposition or on the side of the governing party, you already, as we speak, well, that accountability is multifold. The executive is held accountable through the committees that are created. We all are members of each of these committees. That in each committee, there are such mechanisms, committees when we are in session that meet every week to deal with matters, and all of those matters are pointing toward the accountability of the executive. It can be varied in terms of different themes and programs and so on, but that on its own is a very intensive form of accountability to our executive. The work we do in our constituencies again connects with how we make the executive accountable. And we all have constituencies where we pick up these issues and attend to these issues, and sometimes we then use those issues that we pick up as to raise them in committees, to raise them in debates, to raise them in questions. So there's a plethora of forums, multifold way of making the executive accountable. It's available to us in their various forms. So there's no shortage of that. That we need. Well, I would share the argument if you had a limited space to interface with the executive, that maybe let's look for more new things, because it might also just not help to create new things. And when even the new thing that you're going to introduce would not be effective in that. We've just been speaking about the delay in responses and so on. And so maybe there is a way that we need to pull back and then say, how do we make what we have effective before you introduce any new measures? That's really going to be my take, Chair. I have no problem if Honorable Singh says maybe there's more thinking that some of us would need to do, that they need to go back and check on this. But this is a discussion, this is a debate. And the absence of interpellation certainly does not mean that the executive is not held accountable. I think we must debunk that issue. The executive is already held accountable through a variety of forms of accountability, and I would have listed some of those. So, Chair, I just wanted to come in that way. But my main issue is, can we be in a position to therefore redesign your mini plenaries to attend to some of the issues that you would have wanted to attend in the form of an interpellation? And as I end, it was my passion, this interpellation thing. Almost every sitting, I had an interpellation, but it is an exclusive form, as you say, Chair. It's limited, doesn't include everybody else in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chanchi. It's good that we have honorable members who experience this. Unfortunately, some of us, we have never experienced the interpellations. Thanks for your input, Honorable Papo.
Delayed lowering.
Thank you very much, honorable members. What I've heard here is that interpellations were there in the past and they were discontinued. Our rules provide for many platforms for us also to hold the executive accountable, and it allows for multi-party participation. So I've heard members that they want to go and consult the caucuses. That's Honorable Singh. We will not deny you that opportunity, but also to say that this is a subcommittee of the Rules Committee. We don't take decisions here. If we have different views, we take those to the Rules Committee. That's where a decision will be taken. So it's not like the Rules Committee will sit tomorrow or next week. So that will allow all parties to consult their caucuses. Then when we go to the Rules Committee, we know exactly. Each party will know what is it that they want. They want to see when it comes to account for members of the executive to account to the House. So in that vein, I suggest that we step off this item. We have spoken at length. I don't think there will be a need for us to come back to the subcommittee to process it. We made our inputs, made our comments, so the administration will have to take the inputs for those who are for and for those who are against to the Rules Committee. I think this will assist the process, because if we don't agree, it doesn't mean that those views cannot be taken to the Rules Committee. So we are done with this item. We can go and consult our caucuses, then take it to the Rules Committee. Mr. Paso?
Thank you, ma'am. I just wanted to check, ma'am, whether a lot has been said about mini plenaries. whether you require us as administration to do anything around mini plenaries in light of what, of some of the ideas and views that have been expressed around maybe improving mini plenaries. Thank you.
I think when we have these mini plenaries embedded in our rooms, the view was to ensure that all parties are given an opportunity to debate issues. We know that the rules doesn't allow mini plenaries to take decisions, but issues, matters, anything can be debated in the mini plenaries and be taken to the House for a decision. So if the administration can improve the use of that we channel debates more often to mini plenaries, I think that will also assist us to ensure that everyone participates in the mini plenaries. And also there was a view that in Parliament, we are all allowed to sit in any committee, to participate in on any committee. Then while consulting our members, we can also encourage them to participate anywhere they want to participate. No one is restricted from attending any committee meeting except for one committee, for two committees that cannot be attended by anyone other than the members of those committees, the Joint Standing Committee and the Ethics Committee. I think let's go and consult, then we'll take this matter to the Rules Committee. Honorable Singh?
No, no, thank you very much for that, Chair. I agree that we should consult. But I thought Mr. Castro's question also related to perhaps looking at the possibility, if we have interpellations, have it during mini plenaries. Is that possible? Because it's not a plenary as such. There's no decision taken. Is that a possibility? And I thought this is what Mr. Castro was saying, unless I understood him wrongly.
Honorable Singh, thank you very much. Let's go and consult our caucuses. Then a decision will be taken in the Rules Committee. Thank you very much. Let's step off this item and move to the next one.
Chairperson? Can you hear me?
Mr. Paran?
Yes. So the next item is changes to the procedures relating to the removal of members from the House. That's annexure... D, which is now on the screen. So I'll present on this. Just by way of a background, brief background, members will be aware of the incidences in June where allegations were raised in the House that certain staff members from Parliament's Protection Services had sexually harassed members. This is when they were being removed from the House. And then following these allegations, Parliament appointed a legal counsel to investigate them. And this report from Council was then tabled at the Rules Committee on the 6th of September. In short, the Rules Committee agreed that the subcommittee should consider the relevant rules in light of the findings of the report. Annexure D, I think, lists the findings. So in short, the report made two observations. The first was that in the case of Parliament's Protection Services and in the removal of members from the House, those of one gender should not touch members of Parliament from another gender. And this principle would obviously also apply to members. The second observation related to the need for members to comply with the rules and rulings of presiding officers in general. So we have prepared proposals to address both these observations. I should say the Rules Committee effectively endorsed these recommendations, although left it to the subcommittee in terms of how exactly they should be implemented. So in terms of Rule 73, and this is as well as Annexure C to the current rules, which all relate to the removal of members from the House, Rule 73 allows the House to make standard operating procedures to regulate how members can be removed. That's in Annexure C to the rules, the current rules. So I should first say that we've proposed that Rule 73 be amended to replace standard operating procedures with guidelines. And the reason for this is that rules, including the appendixes to the rules, should, as a matter of principle, relate more to members than staff. And currently, the standard operating procedures, which
as I said, are annexed C, part of the rules, relate mostly or more to what's expected of staff. But that's not to say that these, even if they were in the form of guidelines, were not enforceable. They would be enforceable. The rules say that guidelines must also be enforced. So the proposal is that Rule 73 sub 13 be amended to say there that instead of the House, it'll now say the Rules Committee may approve, and then if you remove standard operating procedures, you can add directives and guidelines for the exercise of the function, that being the removal of members by the Parliamentary Protection Services. And then if that was agreed, then the Annex C would also be changed then to guidelines. So that is the one initial amendment. The substantive amendment, though, if you like, is to the guidelines, or to the standard operating procedures themselves. They say currently that, the Parliament Protection Personnel may enter the chamber upon the instruction of the presiding officer and proceed to remove the member under the direction of the Sergeant at Arms. And what we are proposing now is that we'll say Parliamentary Protection Services personnel of one gender may not touch a member of another gender, and members of one gender may not touch a Parliamentary Protection Officer of another gender. So as I said, this principle was endorsed in the report and by the Rules Committee. I do want to just raise, though, that as a principle, I think everyone certainly agrees with the principle. It is the practicality of some of the what could occur in the House might be a challenge. Members will know sometimes the House gets quite chaotic. So one would need to bear in mind, if this was the amendment, how to provide possibly for different scenarios. But just to return to the proposals, so the investigative report also raised the issues of members' adherence to the standards of conduct, in other words, the general decorum of the House. So in that respect, we've proposed an amendment to Rule 203, which refers to the functions of the subcommittee on the removal of members from the House. And members will know that when members are removed from the House, there must be the circumstances of such removal must be referred to a subcommittee to assess that the procedures were followed and what exactly the circumstances were. So what we're now suggesting is that the mandate of that committee be amended somewhat. So this is Rule 203 sub 1, be amended to read that the conduct of the member concerned, and this is the addition now, the underlined part, so the committee must investigate the conduct of the member concerned specifically in relation to the rules and statutes concerning the rights and conduct of members. And then following from that, so in other words, this would relate to things like freedom of speech, the powers and privileges of members in terms of the Powers and Privileges Act and so on. So in other words, the mandate of the subcommittee, I'm not talking about the rules subcommittee, on the removal of members should be tweaked to specify that one of the issues they must look at is, in other words, check what do the rules say in each case and what do the relevant statutes say, and make a recommendation or finding on that basis as well, together with the other issues that it must consider. So, ma'am, that's my presentation. Mr. Carlson may also have input. Thanks.
With your permission, ma'am.
Yes, Mr. Carlson.
Yes, I think if you can just go to point two, this one. Yeah. I think the one thing that I would like members to be aware of, as we consider this, where it says members of one gender may not touch a parliamentary protection. May not touch a permanent protection office of another gender. Permanent protection services personnel of one gender may not touch a member of another gender. Members of one gender may not touch. There are instances where, and we really don't want to see those instances, where there's really chaos. And let's say, for instance, members of female members, female staff members are overpowered by a female member, and there may be instances where there is a need for reinforcement. So the use of may take care of that. We just wanted to say to members, it's not always like it goes as if there will not be this thing is done orderly. Sometimes there will every effort to do this, but there may be instances that are really where you are not able to strictly comply with this. So we think May will be permissive enough to allow for those. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pastor. Honorable members, here's the presentation with regard to the removal of members from the House. Any takers? Or we agree with the proposals that they are making? That, okay, Honorable Papo?
Ultimately, members, a point where the deciding officer requests the Parliamentary Protection Services to remove a member is a last resort when a member is defying a ruling that they must leave the House. And it should not lead to that state. The fact that a member disobeys a ruling of a presiding officer to leave the House and then causes drama leading to a point where the sergeant at arms have to ask them. They refuse even the sergeant of arms to actually, when they advise them that the ruling has to be implemented. I think it's a sad state of affairs. We should not have members who do that kind of thing. When a presiding officer tells them to leave, they should leave. It happens, you just leave because you have reached a point where the presiding officers, you are actually creating a disorder, you are actually violating the rules, and so on. I think we should actually explain this to our members, that we should not reach a stage where the PPS has to be used. But when you reach that stage, they have to lift you and remove you. And I think he's right, member, Mr. Castro, that at times, even the police, they use both in an event where the police officers of that gender are actually either being disrespected, they are being attacked. That those instances have when they come. That's why the word is actually when in those circumstances, but under normal circumstances, a female member should be removed by a female PPS, and a male must be removed by those. And you don't expect resistance. This resistance also creates a problem. Why does a member resist when they have actually defied a presiding officer ruling? They now resist being removed. How can you have a member like that? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Papo. Honorable Isoma?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I agree and I support the proposal put by the administration. Also sharing the same note with sentiments with Honorable Papu. Safe to say that you can't also control the behavior of other political party members and all that, which is quite unfortunate. But I think probably as Parliament is a continuous issue that we need to engage to say we must respect the rules of the House. Thank you, Chair. The other one, Chair, before I thank you, is the one that is a clarity seeking, having supported what has been presented before us. What happens to a member if it's she or he is removed from the House in terms of the precinct? Is that member goes outside the precinct of Parliament or just get removed from the House? And also the docking of the salary, where does it apply? Is there any rule that talks to that? If it's a serial offender, so to speak. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Songma. I don't see other takers on this matter. It seems as if we are agreeing with the proposal put forward by the administration. So, Mr. Paso, can you please assist?
Thank you, ma'am. Talking of salary, no, it does not... does not obtain in respect of these rules, but it obtains in respect of sanctions that are authorized by the Powers and Privileges Act, and also I think by the Ethics Code. I'll just have to verify that, but not in terms of this particular dispensation. It applies in other respects. But there's been a view expressed by members that, but maybe the rules of the NA that relate to order also need to get into that space, and that has not happened yet. Secondly, the rules say that members must be removed from the precincts of parliament. And so that's what the rule provides for. There would be capacity issues sometimes, especially when you have a number of members who may be involved in a conduct that the presiding officer considers as disorder or disorderly conduct, where you have to attend to the house, while you must also attend to removing members from the precincts of parliament. So there are sometimes capacity issues there, but the rules say member removed must get out of the precincts of parliament. What is not applicable is automatic suspension. Members may be aware that the current text of the rules still has a provision that says that a member who is physically removed is automatically suspended. That served before court about 3 or 4 years ago, and the court said, no, you can only effect suspension after a process, after due process. So that rule is not invoked because of a court order in that regard. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pastor, for that response. Honorable Soma, is that a legacy hand or a new one?
It is a legacy hand. It will disappear, Chair. My apology.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Honorable Mr. Pastor, for that clarification. So I think we agree, all of us, we agree that physical removal of members should be done in accordance with the rights of individuals, which means that a female member can be removed by a female PVS, and also a male member can be removed by a male PPS. So the other methods. Honorable Papu?
Just wanted to make clarity from Mr. Castle. The ridiculing of the PPS being called bouncers, is that a normal thing to do, or is there, it's mocking or something? Because I raised that issue in the last sitting, and I was surprised people think it's a normal thing to call PPS, our official parliamentary protection services, bouncers. Bouncers normally work in nightclubs and so on, and they deal with drunk patrons and things like that. And normally they also apply physical force, clap people and things like that. I just wanted to understand, because it was said it will be checked, but I found it odd that some members found it normal to call PPS bouncers.
Mr. Pastor?
I do know that Honorable Dombe is still going to rule on the matter, but certainly, I mean, any derogatory word or term should not be acceptable, except that staff would not be covered by the rules, but staff would be covered by the Powers and Privileges Act, which gives right of reply to things that are said in the House. So I think that's the only limitation. Members can be urged not to get into that space, because but staff cannot answer for themselves. That's really the issue. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Pastor. Honorable Kwakube?
Chair, I would not want to take us back. I think you were concluding and summarizing. Look, I think for the purposes of now, I think the wording of the rule is fine. But I just do want to just flag with the committee that at some point the issue around gender will be challenged. I don't think maybe it may be a problem in this parliament, but I do want to flag that in the current sort of dispensation that we are in, there will be members who are gender non-conforming. I think let's not necessarily rule or make rules for a future eventuality, but it will come. It may not be relevant now, but it will come. And both the issue of capacity sometimes, where, you know, do we have equal number of female PPS that are available to remove the disorderly members, and also the issue where there may be challenges in future by members to say, you know, they are gender non-conforming, therefore the wording may be tricky, but that's for a future discussion. I just wanted to just flag that at some point we may have to deal with that, but for now I think you are on the right track.
Thank you very much, Honorable Wahove. Just to remind all of us that the rules are continuously being reviewed, being amended, all those things. So let's not worry about the future, because they will still be reviewed and be amended and be established, those new rules. So thanks for that input. I was saying, honorable members, for now, we are stuck with that, the decision as proposed by this the administration, that female members will be removed by female PPS and male as such. So we cannot, honorable members, not encourage the presiding officers to enforce the rules. The rules will assist us to ensure that the house runs smoothly without any disruptions by members of parliament. So if parties are unable to contain their members, then the PPS are there for that. Then when it comes to the issue of removing members from the precinct of parliament, we'll need to look into that and also to make sure that we try our level best to tighten these rules, because we are supposed to be honorable members of parliament who are also role models to some young people out there who want to be members of parliament. If we respect ourselves, then they will learn something from us. But the disruptive behavior in the house where members are forcefully removed is uncalled for. If we are dear to the rules, then none of this will happen. Then the name calling and also the rules covers us, yes, but we have members of parliament who are called something that are not in the rules, but there are members who keep on doing that. It's unacceptable. Thank you very much, honorable members. Can we step off this item and move to the next one?
Yes, thank you, ma'am. The penultimate item is the submission by Mr. Singh for an oversight committee on the presidency. He did submit a letter to the committee, which he can advise if you would like us to flight that. I know that he's also made reference to one or two other documents, which he must again advise. If he wants us to put that on the screen, we can do that. Thanks.
Honorable Singh.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I note that it's almost 12:15 and we've got 15 minutes to go to the closure of this meeting. So I'll be guided by you how much you want me to motivate this particular issue. And when you think I've said enough, then you can stop me. But let me, can they fly?
Try to summarize, honorable Singh.
I'm going to do so.
Too long. We don't have all day. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay. Can they flight the letter? Firstly, you wrote to me on the 16th of September, Chairperson, indicating that, and I'll read it, on a number of occasions, you have proposed that the National Assembly establish a committee on the presidency. At its last meeting on 2 September, the Rules Committee resolved to refer this matter to the subcommittee. The subcommittee intends to meet at the next available opportunity. When I received your letter, I sent this correspondence to yourself, followed by further correspondence that I would like to speak to. Briefly, Honorable Chairperson, the whole issue of an oversight committee over the president is similar to the oversight committee over any member of the executive. The Constitution of the Republic of South Africa is quite clear where it tells us that in exercising legislative power, the National Assembly may consider, pass, amend legislation. Two, the National Assembly must provide for mechanism, must, it's peremptory, to ensure that all executive organs of state in the national sphere of government are accountable to it and to maintain oversight of the exercise of national executive authority, including the implementation of legislation and any organ of state. Now, I firstly want to say that the vote one, which is one of the 41 votes, belongs to an executive organ of state. It falls under the president, but here we must not mix the president as a person and the department which the president manages. So if we look at the constitution, it's preemptory. If we look at the rules of our rules and order, it says in 57.2, the rules and orders of the National Assembly must provide for the established composition, powers, functions, and procedures for committees, and here to interface to all the committees that we have. So what I'm saying, Honorable Speaker, it's not some luxury that we can decide as Parliament that we need or need not have. It's preemptory. It's in terms of our constitution, which we proudly adopted. It is there in our rules. And to motivate further, one may say, well, we have the minister in the presidency and all these other ministers that are accounting. They are accounting for portions of the budget. But if you look at the vote, one, the president, there are a number of bodies that have been created, climate change, corruption, anti-corruption, something on energy, and there is no accountability on the spending of these particular bodies. So all in all, Honorable Chairperson and colleagues, I don't know why we've delayed this implementation of Vote 1. We need to have oversight. And finally, if one refers to the Zondo Commission, and I think they can flight the recommendations of the Zondo Commission, which spoke to this particular matter, and in it, the findings of the commission were that we must consider, I think that's too small. I don't know how you can enlarge that, Perrin. But I'm going to read from the notes that I have here. There is a section in the Zondo Commission, number 1000, and it's listed a parliamentary committee to exercise oversight over the president. The commission heard the views of several witnesses to establish a committee. I'm not reading all because of time. And it became apparent that this is an issue that is and continues to be debated. There's a view held by some that there is little need for such executive functions delegated to the president, which is overseen by a portfolio committee. One must also bear in mind that questions serve as an important part, but again, he said, it is therefore recommended that Parliament should consider whether it's appropriate to establish a committee whose function is or includes oversight over acts or omissions by the president and presidency. If it supports the principle, it will need to determine the details. So this is what I am saying, that we have to determine the details of the establishment of such a committee. That is my case. And in saying that, we are not questioning the president. We are questioning the director general in the presidency over spending patterns within that vote one. We have an oversight committee, which you and I serve on, Honorable Chairperson, Joint Standing Committee on the Financial Management of Parliament. We have other oversight committees that hold accounting officers accountable. It is very, very embarrassing when during the debate on Vote 1, which takes us 2 days, that members of all parties have to place certain issues before the president as a person, which he may not be directly aware of. And these issues can well have been answered when a portfolio committee questions the Director General. So that is my submission, and I think that I'm encouraging honorable members to consider the implementation of the establishment of Vote One Parliament, as is done in all provinces. All premiers have oversight over them, and I don't see why we should be different at a national level. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I've tried to summarize as much as possible.
Thank you very much, Honorable Singh, for your presentation. From the administration side, do you have anything to present in this regard before I open the floor for members?
Chairperson, no, we don't have a presentation on this. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. Honorable members, that is the presentation by by Honorable Singh. Honorable Kwakube.
Thank you, Chair. I think Honorable Singh has made a very compelling case, particularly again linking it to the point that I made earlier about the fact that it is also our collective responsibility to really reform the public persona or the reputation of Parliament. Over the years, the reputation of Parliament has been seen as that one of a rubber stamping institution that doesn't take accountability seriously. That's the one thing. And I think if there are opportunities for us to deepen accountability, we ought to. And not only for accountability's sake, but also to really garner the trust of the public when they see us learning from what is seen to be previous mistakes. And the Zondo Commission makes it quite, you know, clear that there are gaps in our accountability mechanism. Then the second point I want to make is that increasingly, okay, we've seen over the years that the presidency, and not necessarily the president, and I want to caution here that when we're making rules or when you're making legislation or rules, we don't do so with a particular person in mind. You do so on a matter of principle. And whether the president is the current president or somebody else in the next term or whatever the case may be, you want to make a decision and a case for the rules on the basis of principle. But increasingly, we have seen the presidency have bodies and task teams that report in the presidency. And while, yes, one may argue that there are ministers in the presidency who will go and account to various portfolio committees, but there's a definite lacuna in our rules where we have no overview of the entire presidency that is not viewed in drips and drabs. An overview on the entire presidency, on the spending patterns, on the budget, how it is spent, the strategic goals. And this is not in relation to the president's sona and the debate that happens or the president's budget vote that happens, where really the debate, as Honorable Singh says, just degenerates into a political debate. But what happens to the substantive questions around budget spending, around priorities, around targets that are met or not met? No one is answering those questions on the behalf in the presidency in its entirety. We have nothing to lose but everything to gain by instituting a vote one portfolio committee that would essentially look at the presidency as a separate vote, as it is considered already in terms of budgeting in Parliament. And so I would urge the committee to consider that we take this to the Rules Committee for decision, because I do think that it is something that it would really deepen accountability. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kwakube. Honorable Lusuma.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. And I think as a subcommittee, there are issues that probably we need to look at. It's quite an interesting point that are advanced by both Honorable Singh and Honorable Kwakube. The only thing that for me I would like to underscore in terms of Zondo's Commission report, that the Parliament may consider, that's one, but also in that report, it doesn't appreciate that the president is not the member of the parliament or of the National Assembly or parliament, because immediately gets appointed, the individual sits to be the member of parliament. Hence, that individual is the head of the state that presents and outlines the broader government policies which are implemented by various departments. Even the examples that Honorable Singh made, there are relevant committees that I think probably moving forward, learning from the COVID times and the way we operate now moving forward in a hybrid manner,
that needs to look at how best they can also make sure that if there are any other issues extraordinary that the workings of the committees and departments that the country needs to attend to, it doesn't lose sight of the oversight bodies that they're supposed to be of being oversighted by. For an example, we established the ad hoc committee on floods precisely that we knew that they will pocket the redirecting of funds that needs a special committee to deal with that. It sounded very interesting when Honorable Kwakubé, while separating the president and the presidency, but also in the same tone, she also appreciates that there are committees. For me, for now, Chair, let it be an ongoing discussion, which may be towards the end of our term, we can say that the incoming, administration, the sixth administration, seventh administration may look at, because it also then in team talks to what the constitution says in terms of the president that immediately gets appointed, then seems to be a member of parliament. How then that one needs to be worked with, because it's not a simple thing of just establishing a committee. There are also a legal imperative that we need to consider, unintended consequences by virtue of just agreeing. For me, I would say that it's an ongoing debate. For now, what we have, it works. Various committees, they are dealing with a matter. Any specific issue that members want to hold the president I also must appreciate the angle that Honorable Singh says that there's a head of the office of the president, but that person doesn't account to us, the president, through the questions which are then scheduled in and agreed timeously. And I think it works for us, Chair, unless I'm convinced otherwise that there is any other thing. Other than that, what on Judge Zondo's report and its recommendation does also uplift to say that there's a better effort and intended input that members of parliament must put to hold both the executive and the president accountable through various platforms that earlier on we've been discussing on and reach agreements on. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Isoma. Honorable Papo.
Members, I just want to understand how we are using the Zondo report. There's a bit of a piecemeal we take there. Because I thought there was an understanding that all the issues relating to Gondo will be consolidated and actually formally dealt with. This one relates to this one, this one. So I'm just saying, was this report on the recommendation referred to the subcommittee, or are we going to choose and pick which one we want? Because I think, whether there's a decision on which one, are we going to, because I'm a bit worried if we're going to use Zondo Commission recommendations like that. When we had agreed in principle that there will be reference to some of the all issues which relate to our two specific committees and so on. What is the sense? Because we may need I need to have an understanding. Now we've got this 3-page or 4-page, another one may pop up and so on. And to me, it's not the best way of dealing with that report. But waiting on the president to submit the report for the executive part and a plan. I'm just a bit concerned the way we're dealing with the report.
Thank you, Honorable Papo. Honorable Singh?
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I knew you would give me an opportunity to respond, if I may just respond. Firstly, let's say for the purposes of this discussion, let us ignore what the findings of the Zondo Commission report were. So I'm taking it off the table, but it was used just as a way of emphasizing that it is not only Parliament that is dealing with this issue, but there are people outside of Parliament that have made recommendations. But I'm taking what Zondo Commission says out of the report, and I want to come back to what the Constitution of this country says to all of us, and what the National Assembly needs to do in terms of Section 55(2). And I want to read it again. The National Assembly must provide for mechanisms to ensure that all executive organs of state in the national sphere of government are accountable to it. Now, I want to submit, and I agree with Honorable Lissouma, that yes, the president doesn't is no longer a member of parliament, but the constitution refers to national, to executive organs, and he is the head of the executive. The head of the executive in this country is the president of this country. Now, how does it make sense that you hold all other executives, 41 of them, 40 of them accountable for spending within their respective departments, but you leave the head of the executive? So what we are doing, Honorable Chairperson and colleagues, I respectfully submit, is unconstitutional. As Parliament, we have to adhere to what the Constitution says, and it says that we must exercise and maintain oversight over all executive organs of state. And yes, I used the argument earlier, which I said will come up, that there is some reporting, but I have done an assessment, and I think the administration could help using the Parliamentary Budget Office to analyze the budget of Vote 1. And you will find that there are hundreds of millions of rand that's allocated from the fiscus to Vote 1 where there is no accountability whatsoever. The ministers that reside within the presidency are accountable for certain portions of the budget, but there are large portions of Vote 1 where there is no accountability. And if that continues to persist, we are in breach of the Constitution as the National Assembly of South Africa. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Sting. Honorable Gwakube?
Chair, I do want to underscore two points that I think that were made. I mean, I think it's important to understand that when we separate the president from the presidency, we are of the understanding that the president has a department called the presidency. And so while other departments have oversight committees, the presidency doesn't. And whether or not accept that the application or the use of the Zondo Commission report, as Honorable Papo says, is in a piecemeal fashion, that's besides the point. The point is this has been a matter which has been raised over and over again in Parliament. Again, in my view, this is an oversight in our role. And whether or not we have started the work of implementing some of the recommendations of the Zondo Commission report, that's besides the point. If we can see that there's an oversight lacuna in the rules, then we must address it. And the notion that this can be something that can be considered at a later stage, for me, is quite frankly wild. Why do we want to say, why do we kick for touch and say maybe this will be something else that another parliament can deal with? Here we are as a subcommittee that deals with the rules, and it is clear that there are sections of government which do not have an oversight body that looks at it as per is required by the constitution from us. So let's fix what is broken now. I mean, I just don't understand why we've got to say it works now. It doesn't work. There are things that are not answered for, which don't fall neatly in the purview of other committees, which can be neatly tucked into a presidency portfolio committee. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Kwahube. Honorable Kenji?
No, Chair. Mine will be brief. I think I'm assisted by Honorable Singh, because I have this hanging question. And he seems to be attending to that. The hanging question I have is, under the presidency, when you have the Joint Committee on Intelligence, the committee established, and the president is responsible for that constitutionally, but the committee is. There's committee for women, people with vulnerabilities. the DPSA that's monitoring and evaluation. So the question I had, which I think Honorable Singh is getting into it, but I don't want us to deal and take decisions or recommendations on vague matters. Because my question was, where is this gap of accountability from the presidency? And Honorable Singh says, pointing to the way forward, that perhaps it would assist the subcommittee that would get that placed in front of us. Not just the narratives. They say here are the gaps, and in terms of the budget allocated to it, and that we are not able to make anybody account for these. Honorable Singh seems to be saying that work can be done. And I would want to support that if he needs to be assisted by the committee, we'll bring that back. And we have a discussion, a focused specific discussion on those particular gaps than just being all over the place and make assertions about that there are areas that are not covered when we're not able to pinpoint and confront those areas. Because based on such a discussion, then we might be finding each other converging on certain points, but it can't just be a general discussion. So I'm inviting what Honorable Singh has introduced as a way for us to get into that space. And therefore we can, if the Rules Committee meet next week, we'll indicate that this matter is still being discussed by the subcommittee. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Chanchi. Honorable Papu?
Yeah, I wanted to say I agree with well, we don't clearly what from what Pembalisuma said. The ANC doesn't agree with the proposal, but I think with the inputs which were made, the issue should be kept on the agenda of the subcommittees for further consultation and people coming back on the matter. Because you can simply say we don't agree, we take it the rules, we close it. But for now, there's no agreement, but it must be kept on the agenda for further consultation and looking at other issues and then come back. So that we don't put it on the agenda by saying we're taking to the rules, we take a decision there. But there's no agreement here on the matter, but we don't should not keep it off the agenda.
Thank you, Honorable Papo. I can say that, Honorable Lissouma, you're coming back.
No, thanks very much, Chair. I think the point that I've raised, I was saying as a continuous engagement, it can suggest that way. So I'm covered by some of those. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Lissouma. Honorable Singh?
No, thank you very much, Chairperson, for the interventions by the committee members, particularly Honorable Janji. And I think that, you know, it's taken us 28 years to get here. Another 28 days or 56 days is not going to be a train smash. But the question I'd like to ask of Mr. Castle and the administration there is whether they could assist us by liaising with the Parliamentary Budget Office to give us an analysis of vote one. So what I referred to and what Honorable Janji referred to can actually serve before us in terms of what amount in vote one is not accounted for by anybody through the normal process of a portfolio committee. That is going to assist us, and if Mr. Castle can put some time frames on that. Otherwise, Honorable Chairperson, you see, why do we have a debate on vote one? Is it a political debate? All the other debates are debates on issues of what the department does or does not do. But here, why should we have a debate on vote one then? So I agree. Honorable Janji, thank you for that suggestion. And Chair, I hope you will support it, that the administration get hold of the PBO to present us with those facts and figures that can serve before us at the next meeting. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Members, for your inputs. Honorable Papo, are you coming back?
No, let me still draw my hand.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Members, for your inputs. I just want us not to get out of this meeting saying that there is no accountability in the presidency. There are three committees, oversight committees, in the presidency. What needs to be done is to identify those gaps, as you have said, Honorable Singh and Honorable Janji, come back and discuss it further. So this item will not go to the Rules Committee. It's still work in progress. It will remain on the agenda of this subcommittee. Then we will come back and process it further after identifying those gaps and also being advised on how to move forward in this regard. So I think we are on the same understanding. Perrin, Mr. Kaso?
Thank you, ma'am. I just wanted guidance from yourself, ma'am. Is there anything expected of us as administration to do on this matter?
Honorable Singh was saying that if you can liaise with the budget office with regards to the gaps that you said there are gaps in terms of oversight, oversighting that the budget in the presidency. Because we have three committees that oversees the presidency. So you said there are gaps that are there. So if you can check with the budget office with regard to which budget is not overseen in the presidency, then you can propose how we move forward in this regard. Did I get you correctly, Honorable Sir?
No, very correct, Honorable Chairperson. And the PBO, I think, is the best place to assist and work with Mr. Kassel.
Honorable Chanji?
I was going to say you are very accurate, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, Perrin, where are we now?
Last item is closing.
Okay, thank you very much, Perrin. Honorable members and the officials from Parliament, thank you very much for this fruitful meeting. In all our meetings, we do disagree, but the work of Parliament continues. So it's not the end of the road. We will go to the Rules Committee, and also on the last item, we'll still come back and process it further in the subcommittee before it goes to Parliament. Thanks for your participation, your inputs, and recommendations. Thank you very much for hosting us to our officials. The meeting stands adjourned.
Thank you very much, Chair, and have a good weekend, colleagues.
You too,
it's
colleagues.
It's Diwali this weekend, Honorable Chair, on Monday. So I'm going to rejoice on Monday. It's our Christmas.
Yeah, we'll rejoice.